You know what time it is. Time to hang out.
Hang with Mr. Cool.
We're Mr. Cooper. We're Mr. Cooper. We're Mr. Cooper.
Get the ladies cool.
From Mr. Cooper. From Mr. Cooper. From Mr. Cooper.
Hang with Mr. Cool.
We're Mr. Cooper. We're Mr. Cooper. We're Mr. Cooper.
Get the ladies cool.
From Mr. Cooper. From Mr. Cooper.
Welcome to the Bit Scoop with Coop. I'm your host, Coop. Big shout outs to everybody that's listening right now on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to. Also, don't forget, if you want to see the video recording of this show, make sure you go to thebitscoopwithcoop.com where you can catch episodes from season one all the way now. Also, you can catch me on Facebook, facebook.com/thebitscoopwithcoop. Also on Instagram, IGTV, baby. You can catch me there at Big Scoop with Coop and on YouTube at The Bit Scoop with Coop. He is a senator from Washington, D.C. He's doing a lot of big things. His name is Senator Paul Strauss. Senator Paul Strauss has been working hard. He has the 51-star campaign that he's actually doing to help make Washington, D.C. become the 51st state. So he's doing a lot of things that's going on. So we're going to talk to him. We're going to find out how he's starting his career. In politics, we will find out when he became a senator, how excited he was, and everything else is going on with him in the political realm. Sit back, relax, and I hope you enjoy this episode of The Bit Scoop with Coop. Right, everybody.
Great to be here with you. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How's your day going so far?
It's getting a lot better. You know, January was one rough month. I mean, first of all, every Wednesday, something crazy happened, starting with the letter I, the insurrection was the first week. The impeachment was the second week. We had the inauguration the third week. So by that fourth Wednesday, I was just holding out for ice storm or what happened with the letter I. It didn't. And you know, we've had a whole week and it was, you can't say normal because you still got people in Congress that are talking about lasers in space setting forest fires. And you've got, people threatening to kill other members. So I won't say it's normal, but wow, it's just a lot better than it has been. So some days I find myself almost bored and I haven't been, I got to tell you that's almost a good thing because it used to be just terrified and sad. And so I'll take bored.
And you know what, Senator, I guess we could say this is the most normal it's been in a year.
Absolutely.
That's the best way to put that.
Absolutely. Now, when Jewish space lasers are as normal as it gets, that tells you how totally whacked that last year was. But okay.
You're right about that, Senator. That's why I feel that we have to continue to try to shift this normal back to the normal that we know. If that makes sense, you know, yeah, the space lasers, that's kind of crazy. You're right. Anything that started with the letter I, you had to duck and run. That's what it seemed like, except for the inauguration. But
well, even then, you know, if you saw the security we had here and the fencing and all that, I mean, I've been to lots of inaugurations. This one was, different.
Yes, it was. And it's crazy because about a few weeks ago, I had the CEO of the presidential inauguration, Tony Allen, on the show. And we was talking and everything, how he was trying to get prepared for the inauguration and everything. So it's really different, especially when majority of it was virtual. You know, it wasn't people there. That, yeah. I know that probably was like a funny feeling for Biden and everybody also. I've seen a lot of people online saying, yeah, people weren't using common sense. They was like, more people showed up to the Trump inauguration than the Biden. Duh.
You know what? He can have that. Give him that. Right. He won crowd size. You know, Joe Biden doesn't need that for his ego. He didn't need it. Great. Trump had more people, had a bigger crowd.
Well, Senator, of course, it's virtual COVID. That's why he won the crowd size.
He was a responsible leader. You know, I feel bad for the kids that didn't get to march in that parade. You know, Pennsylvania Avenue, we host marching bands from 50 states, as well as some great groups from D.C. I'm sorry that they couldn't participate in the way that they could, but look, the peaceful transition of power and the ceremony that celebrates it, probably one of the greatest gifts the American people have ever given the world. It has inspired democracy in places where it never existed before, and we almost lost that. And so the fact that he put the safety of others ahead of his own ego and his own grandiosity, certainly this is a man that would have loved to dance with his lovely wife in an inaugural ball and celebrate in the way that we wanted. He got right to work. He was signing orders. That's what you... is an American, the president is our employee, and that guy
so
was,
true.
And that guy was on the job from minute one, you know, not even day one, minute one, serving us with a great deputy, the vice president. How exciting is that to have a woman mm-hmm. of her, you know, and a second gentleman. I mean,
yes.
It was a great day. And you know what? I've been to a lot of inaugurations, and they are cold, right? They're in January. So to be able to watch this one in front of a roaring fire and maybe a cup of something hot or a cup of something, just saying.
Yes, sir.
Great day. Great day for all of us in Washington.
You're right about that. And, Senator, we will get into that later on. We will definitely talk more about the Biden-Harris, era right now. We definitely will talk about that. But, you know, right now, today is about you. You've done a lot in D.C. You've been in the state. You've been helping the state. I mean, even back through the 80s. But let's talk about that for the people that don't know. When did you first realize that you wanted to get into politics?
Oh, I was a 9-year-old kid. I was looking at a magazine article about a guy running for mayor in New York, my hometown, and I decided I wanted to vote for that candidate. And of course, I was too young to vote, but my mother, God bless her, took me down to the candidate's campaign headquarters. Now, if you go to a campaign headquarters today, it's kind of tech heavy, looks more like a server farm. But back then, campaign headquarters were big hotel ballrooms. They had streamers, they had balloons, they had people in those funny styrofoam hats you see in the old timey movies. Not to mention a whole bunch of free snacks, pizza, soda. I thought it was great. It was like a big party. And they put me to work. And this was 1973, so I was like folding paper and putting it in an envelope. I could do that at 9. Then you had to put the stamp on the envelope in just the right way. Well, I could do that at 9. And all of the things, you know, sealing up the envelope, I could do that. And so here I was in the midst of this festive, exciting atmosphere, full of energy, doing something that I knew was important and, frankly, doing it well because I was a great paper folder, envelope stuffer, stamp licker, all of that. And so I'm getting this great positive reinforcement. I'm having the time of my life. And he did not become the mayor. He was a congressman from the Bronx. But he sent me a Christmas card after. And I remember... how great that was because, one, I was a kid, so I didn't get a lot of cards myself from people. Two, we were Jewish, so we didn't get that many Christmas cards at all. And this had a picture of the Capitol after it snowed. It was one of the most beautiful sights I'd ever seen. And it was such a great experience that I went back and I worked for the governor candidate. His name was Hugh Carey, and he won the election. And then 2 years later, I get a call. And again, this is one of those times where, as a kid, when the phone rings, it's not normally for you. But I answered the phone as I had been taught. And they said, I want to speak to Paul Strauss. And I'm all excited. I'm like, you do? And, now, I didn't realize it's a guy going through a stack of index cards, reading off a script, as they do. But to me, I'm getting excited. And he says, we hear from your governor that you're one of the best Democratic operatives in New York State. And I'm so excited. I'm like, you did? And he's like, yes, and we have our governor coming to your state, and we'd like you to meet our governor. He's running for president. Well, I'm excited, and I'm like, who's your governor? And they said, his name is Jimmy Carter, And lo and behold, they invited me to meet Governor Carter when he came to New York. And, you know, so imagine being 12 years old and your mom comes home from work and you're like, hey, I need to miss school next week. Why? I have a meeting with the governor of Georgia. Now, you know, most kids, right, they're going to, you know, fake a fever, this and that. So, you know, who's going to make up that as a way of getting out of school? So, and I ended up going to the, working on the Jimmy Carter for President campaign. And that was my first presidential campaign. I organized a group that was called Kids for Carter. And so I was hooked. I had the campaign bug. I knew I wanted to come to Washington to study political science because we've got some of the best schools for that here. I mean, look, let's face it. If you want to work in films, go to Hollywood. You want to work in finance and Wall Street, you can go to New York. But if you want to study politics and the art of governing, then the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., is the place to be. And so I came here to go to school as a freshman. And little did I realize that in doing what I thought was the most American thing a young kid could do, I was giving up my rights in a democracy by moving to the capital of our nation. It just blew my mind.
Now, that's crazy, Senator. Now, you went from a kid licking stamps, putting the papers in the envelope, working at the age of 9. Turn around, get the phone call for Governor Jimmy Carter to come meet him. Now, we're going to fast forward a little bit. That right there had to stick in your mind for a while, and that had to influence you to continue to go because, like you said, at the age of 9, doing that, a lot of kids at the age of 9 was not even thinking about that. They were thinking about playing with their toys, being outside, running around, being with their friends, watching TV, and look at you putting yourself to work early stage to get yourself to where you are today. Now, when you fast forward, I don't want to get to 1996 right now. Let's jump up a little bit.
Sure. But
what type of hurdles did you go through when you finally got into the political realm, when you passed past childhood?
Well, when I went to university, I started to run for student government. And the interesting thing that happened is I had figured I would go back to New York, maybe run for something there, you know, a lot of people come here and they set their sights on Congress, and I ended up getting involved with the government of Washington, D.C., what they call the city government, but it's really more like our state government because they pass certain laws. So they were actually, as a college freshman, there were some people on the city council that wanted to raise the drinking age from 18 to 21. And let me tell you something. As a young kid who just got here, 18, 19 years old, a whole bunch of college students, we did not want that to happen. We thought that was a bad idea. And in fact, it turned out to be not a great idea for a lot of reasons. But we knew that if we wanted the D.C. Council to take us seriously, we had to start registering to vote right here in D.C., not voting absentee in our home states. And I got together with some leaders of other college campuses, and we began to register students to vote in record numbers. And all of a sudden, the people that would vote for me in student government could then vote in regular elections. And one of the offices we have in D.C., it's called Commissioner, or ANC, stands for Advisory Neighborhood Commissioner. And if what you think of as the city council is kind of our state government, then Commissioner is more like our county and municipal government.
Okay.
And I actually was able to run for that back when I was a junior at my university. So I'm 21 years old, and I'm able to take the people who would vote for me in the student center in student government elections, march them across the street to the church that was the polling place on election day. And I ended up getting enough votes and won the election in 1986. So there I am, still in college, studying political science, actually winning my first elected office. And I've had the privilege of serving the people of D.C. in an elected capacity ever since then. So,
wow,
exciting. You know, you go to vote and you see your own name on the ballot, and it's a good feeling. And it gives you a sense of responsibility. I love serving my community. I love public service.
You know what, Senator? I'm not going to lie to you. Now, if it was me in college and I saw my name on the ballot, after I filled it out, I would ask the people, can I have a blank ballot so I can hang it up on my wall so I can see that for the rest of my life? You know, that's some exciting stuff right there, because it's showing that you actually hit a goal. You know what I'm saying? You really hit a goal where a lot of people in college, you won electoral in college. Come on. That's crazy. You're doing it. You did it.
I was happy to do it, and I represented a lot of folks that were not initially very happy about having some 21-year-old kid becoming their commissioner, because they had serious issues, and it took me the first couple of meetings, there were some rough townspeople there wondering what the heck had happened. I had to work hard to win them over. Earn their trust and develop my credibility to show that this was something that I was ready to take very seriously.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have any mentors to help you out when you actually, you know, won that ballot? Did you have any mentors to help you out during college while you actually running, without running, you won the city,
sure,
the city government side?
Well, American University, where I went, was a great school. We had great professors. We had teachers. We had fellow students that lived and breathed politics. So that was the other thing. You know, when I was in high school and there I was going off to work on political campaigns, I was kind of that weird kid. But when I came to D.C. and enrolled in my program, there were high school students, you know, kids in high school like me from all around the country that maybe they felt weird being so interested in politics at such a young age. But when we got here to D.C., we knew we had come to the right place, and we knew we had found our home. And so I met like-minded people, a strong peer group, good reinforcement, some great teachers, some great professors, things like Campaign Management Institute that taught me the mechanics of how to win an election. And so a lot of them stick out. You know, one of my great mentors now, he's in the national spotlight. He was my law school professor. His name was Jamie Raskin. He represents the state of Maryland. And I actually got elected as a senator before he became a Maryland state senator, but he continues to be a great mentor. And he's recognized as one of the most brilliant minds in American politics. He's a great, brilliant scholar. He is prosecuting the impeachment case against President Trump. I mean, I've been, from 96 on, I have been D.C.'s shadow United States Senator for so long. I'm in my third impeachment trial. I mean, that's where you know you've been around a while. This is my third impeachment trial, you know, two with the same president, but... yeah, so I've had some great mentors, and because of that, I've always done my best to try and bring other young people into the business as well. So even at an early age, we had interns, we've had young people who were always part of my campaigns. This year, for my last reelection, my treasurer was someone who took my old seat on the college campus, a college student that became the treasurer. You know, and so this was somebody who at the age of 19, when they first got elected to the commissioner, became the treasurer. They were the youngest official officer of an ANC district in Washington, D.C. They were capable of signing government checks as a treasurer and not old enough to buy a beer. So that's that should tell you just how crazy some of these things are. But yeah, it's important to my experience as a young person in politics shaped me. And I tried to give those same opportunities to young people as well.
And you know what? The person that you're speaking about, plus yourself, did you ever think about this? Both of you are like the Doogie Howser of the political side. To really think about it. Young age, conquering your realm. I mean, you guys are doing it up. I mean, do you ever sit there and think about that, Senator?
I am, and I'm old enough to remember who Doogie Howser is and remember that show. And I love seeing young people coming up through the ranks, and now they look at me like I'm that old dude. And I have to try and explain that my history, you know, most people don't always know and focus on the history, because we've got 299 ANC commissioners.
Right.
So. I enjoy getting to tell these stories, but we have so many critical issues today that I don't often get to reminisce about the good old days when I was a skinny little kid and all of this was dark hair. And
so. No, understandable. And that's the thing. That's why I'm glad that you remember all of this, because you have to realize one day there's going to be another young person that's going to come in this seat and they're going to look to you, Senator, and they're going to be like, how do I get from step A to step B? And the information that you're going to give to these people and the people that's watching worldwide right now. Listen, I hope you're taking notes and taking jewels, because what's going on, Senator is actually giving you guys his history lesson, how he did this. So if you're trying to get into politics or the government, you better take down some notes, paper, pencil, pen. I'm sorry, I'm talking old school. Get your computer, start typing. Right. Make sure you take these notes down. Now, Senator, we've been yelling out ANC back and forth on this. Let's talk about ANC for a second for the people that don't know what it is. Tell everybody what ANC stands for and what type of role did you take place in the ANC?
Well, it stands for Advisory Neighborhood Commissioner. It is the first spot on the ballot, so that if you go vote for president, and that's at the very top, you go all the way down and all the way down. That's the very last name on the ballot that you would get to vote for. But I think those are important positions because they're the ones that affect people most directly. We dealt with zoning issues. We dealt with land use, licensing of certain business establishments. And so when Washington, D.C. becomes a state, these commission districts will really become the equivalent of sort of our counties, our municipalities. And I think it's very important. And so they get to vote on issues. They set local policy. And it's a great way to do that. And it's a great, good entry-level thing to run for. You know, I encourage young people to run for office, but I don't necessarily think that member of Congress or something like that is probably the first office you should run for. I made a lot of mistakes when I first got into government. The art of governing and the art of campaigning are very, very different. And it takes time to be in government and to see the results of your actual policies come into existence. So you don't always know right away what works and what doesn't work. And you need to be patient. You know, politics is it's not a sporting event. It can be competitive and it can give you that adrenaline rush. But the pace of government moves awfully slow, even in our rapid computerized age, even in the 24-hour news cycle, even in the instantaneous era of social media. A tweet can go viral in 20 minutes, but a bill doesn't become a law that fast, and a law doesn't begin to take effect or give you results that fast. So, you know, the last thing young people want to hear from older folks is patience and take your time. But it's
true.
It's not a quick process, and it takes practice to get it right. And I'm better at the job now than I was when I first started. I have learned experience is a good thing. They often call experience knowledge that you don't get until after you needed it. Well, with that definition,
yes,
made some tough calls.
That's true. Ladies and gentlemen, everyone is watching right now. What you see on CNN, ABC News, trust me, you're seeing the climax part of what they do. There's a lot that goes on that you don't see behind the scenes. That's why Senator Paul is telling you, it's going to take patience. Yes, a tweet can go viral in 20 minutes, but if you know how much work Senator Paul Strauss put behind his work to get to where it's at, it's mind-bending. It's a lot. It's a process. So make sure you take your time when you're doing this. Now, I want to prove to you that it's a process. Now, Senator Paul, I want to talk about one thing that you've done, and I want to bring this up now because I know this took a process. Do you remember that 51-star campaign?
I'm excited about that. It's still going on. We had to take a little hiatus because of the coronavirus. But, yeah, the 51-star campaign is literally an idea I had where you get 51 stars, you know, the Hollywood kind, or sports figures, to help us get 51 stars on the American flag for the 51st state. So it's a pretty creative idea. And I've gotten to meet and work with so many amazing people. Rosario Dawson, Richard Schiff, who from the West Wing played Toby. A lot of people know him. A lot of people see him now on that great show, The Good Doctor. Jonathan Banks from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. He was born in D.C., grew up here, has some great stories about his childhood in our spots. And though, so we are literally reaching out. Jesse Vargas, a boxer who won his title belt here in Washington, D.C. So a lot of great people who are helping us do that. Look, celebrities, star power, they're creative, they're brilliant, they help us attract attention, and it's great when they're going to put their credibility on the line to use their influence to help us get out this serious message that Washington, D.C. needs to become a state. So I love that program. I can't wait to get back to shooting those spots in person.
Now, Senator, how hard was it to actually come up with that plan for the 51-star campaign and figure out which celebrities was best to bring on to this campaign? How hard was it?
Well, we had a lot of great help from a group called the Creative Coalition, which is an organization that channels all that Hollywood star power energy into political good. They're an advocate for the arts. They're an advocate for important causes. And they helped kickstart it by hosting a dinner called their Voices of Impact Dinner. And so the first time we had Mario Van Peebles, we had Evan Handler, who was on some great shows from Californication to Sex in the City, and another young actress. They were our first three, and people saw the spots. They liked the spots. We got, of course, Dave Chappelle. I mean, who you know, I remember from growing up in D.C. I mean, there's really nobody more Washington, D.C. than Dave Chappelle. He did one of those spots. He's been a great supporter of D.C. stated. And so, yeah, how great is it to work with these people who are so talented, so brilliant, and terrific to help us get our message out. So I don't know if you have the spots or we're going to send you some that you could cut, but that's probably, if we hadn't thought of that, we should.
Ah, thank you. Thank you, Senator. Yes, yes. Now, Senator, now, when are you planning to start this campaign back up? I know COVID hit, a lot of things slowed down. Do you have a projected time frame when you're going to actually start putting your whole hand back into it again?
Well, when it's safe. I mean, as much as I like doing it, we have to find a way to do it safe. You know, the District of Columbia has been hit hard by this coronavirus. One of the stupidest things that Congress did is they didn't give us the resources that we needed. We are not a state, so they gave us one-third of the coronavirus resources to fight this pandemic. And I know we talk a lot about Trump and that administration not understanding the science, not following the science. I don't know what their thinking is. I suppose that was there someone in the administration that thought, well, it's a mutating microbiologic organism, so I assume it's going to understand the political distinctions between a terrier and a state, and maybe it'll just make the people of Washington, D.C. only one-third as sick. Well, that didn't happen. Or maybe it will just make Washington, D.C. residents, it'll only affect one-third of them. Well, that didn't happen either. In fact, it has hit this city hard. We have lost so many people to this disease, the majority of them people of color. And so as much as I would love to be flying off to Hollywood or bringing celebrities here or hanging out at these events, we're not going to do it again until it's safe.
And, understandable.
But we haven't hit 51. We're looking for them. It's an ultimate casting call for democracy. But look, the truth is, even without all 51 stars, with the few that we've got momentum in the House. We've got momentum in the Senate on our bill. We might get to be a state without needing them all. So we'll see what happens.
Well, I believe great things are going to happen, Senator, off of this. You all have the manpower and you all have the connections to get who you need in there. I believe that you all have more support, especially under the Biden-Harris era, than before, you know, for the last 4 years. So I believe that people will come into this. The only thing you have to do is just ask. I don't believe no one is going to say no. So you have my full support on that also, Senator.
Thank you.
Yes, you definitely do. Now, I want to go to 1996 real quick. You become senator. How excited were you when you found out that you became senator in D.C.?
Well, I mean, it was a great day. You know, Reverend Jesse Jackson had the spot before me. He had decided not to run again. And I jumped into the race, and I had only been a commissioner, had not run district-wide or statewide, as it were, before. So this was my first foray. And, you know, I had to compete in my party's primary. And then when I won the Democratic primary, I felt reasonably confident I would be elected. But, you know, the process for becoming D.C.'s shadow United States senator is really the same is any other U.S. senator. You run in your primary, you have to get on the ballot the same way, you have to meet the same requirements. In fact, I was only 31 years old, and so the last time the seat was up, I wasn't even legally old enough to run for it.
Wow.
So when I got in, and I don't want to take anything away from my my friend John Ossoff, who was also one of the most recent people to come in and get elected in his early 30s, but people talk about Joe Biden getting elected right at the minimum age, and we're talking about John Ossoff. But, you know, in between those two guys was this guy here. Just saying, couldn't vote. But it was a great moment. And they swore me in on January 2nd, 1997. And my dad came down. He was there. It was one of the first time I got to see him cry, actually. He was very moved. So that was kind of I think I remember that more than a lot of the other issues. You know, so much was going on. But every swearing in is memorable. Even this time where we had to do it virtually. But I remember that it was a big day. And
yes.
You know, if becoming a commissioner at 21 was a big deal, becoming a senator at 31, you felt that way as well.
Now, if you had a time machine and you can go back to your 21-year-old self and your 9-year-old self and tell yourself that you're going to become senator, do you think you would believe? You think you'll believe it?
It's hard to say. You know, that experience at an early age at 9. Was very reinforcing, because even though the skill sets were fairly modest, and I made some mistake back then. I mean, I used to hang campaign posters. I was good at that. Putting bumper stickers on cars. Turns out you're supposed to get the permission of the person who owns the car before you put the sticker on. So, hey, kids, if you're on a campaign, don't just start putting stickers on people's car. It really pisses them off. And may actually lose votes for your candidate. So, I'm not saying I was a whiz right out of the gate, but I knew, not that I was destined for great things, but I knew that the electoral process was a great opportunity to be able to serve. And so whatever would happen, I knew I wasn't wasting my time. I knew it would be an ability to do things. I didn't know what they would be. In all honesty, I did not think that becoming the 51st state would take this long, and because it seems such a simple, equitable, decent thing to do for your fellow Americans. So I may have been a little bit naive. I may have been a little bit overly idealistic. I hadn't estimated the cynicism and how entrenched these partisan people are about staying in power. So.
Well, Senator, do you feel like it was because of the last 4 years, all this other craziness went on, that it got put on the back burner? Do you feel like that, or do you think all hands are still on deck trying to get it?
The last four years opened up some wounds and divisions that were really already there. Let's have some straight talk about why D.C. really is what it is. You know. I love the musical Hamilton. It was a great show, and they did a lot of great things, especially with non-traditional casting and giving people opportunities on Broadway where they otherwise wouldn't. And they told an amazing story from our American history. They kind of glossed over a part of it, though, that we don't really like to talk about. So everybody understands that the North needed the Southern states to assume the national debt, the Revolutionary War debt, and the South really wanted the capital in the South. But we don't talk about why. Was it just they didn't like the commute? Was it just the convenience? Was it just the prestige? I'm sure that played a role, but the real issue was slavery. When George Washington became the first president, he took an enslaved person that he considered to be his property named Horatio up to Philadelphia with him, who was his cook. And, you know, cook isn't even really the right word. This was an enslaved person that George Washington, under the laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia then, literally owned his property. And under the laws of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, after 6 months, Horatio would have had to have been freed. So Washington would send him back just before the 6 months was up and bring him back to keep him in a slave status. Occasionally, Horatio would escape, and Washington was upset that the Pennsylvania authorities wouldn't return this living human person who Washington considered to be property to him. And so having the capital in a slave jurisdiction where they would maintain the issue of slavery and be able to keep their enslaved people was one of the main reasons why Washington, Jefferson, these founding fathers really wanted the capital in the South. The Capitol building was built by slave labor. Now, the government compensated every hour that the slaves worked at market rates, but they paid it to the slave owners. So we have this terrible legacy of systemic racism that is part of the District of Columbia origin story that we really need to address. And so, no, D.C. not having equality, D.C. not having democracy, D.C. not having voting rights, isn't new in the Trump era. It's as old as the Civil Rights Movement. D.C. had some territorial government in the Civil War, and when they passed the amendments that guaranteed equal suffrage by race, it was decided to take away all voting rights in D.C. rather than give them to the African Americans that were making a name. Frederick Douglass was a D.C. government municipal official. He was elected as our recorder of deeds and served the local government. And so at the end of Reconstruction, when the Confederacy sort of reasserted itself with Jim Crow laws and the Klan, D.C. lost its self-rule and its home rule and its ability to self-govern. We have pictures in the Wilson Building where my office is of Dr. King marching for home rule in the 60s. And so as we had these legacies of civil rights, D.C. kind of got left behind. And yeah, the Trump administration and the white nationalism, the racism that was part of that, certainly didn't allow D.C. statehood to advance. But
that is true.
We cannot look. There's a whole bunch of things I'm going to be that we could fairly blame Donald Trump for. This is not one of them. This has been part of systemic racism for a long time, and it's really time we need to address it. And there are really three incidents from 2020 that are just making this an issue for now. The first, of course, was President Trump's, I'll blame him for this, let's be frank, as protests around the nation justifiably erupted in the Black Lives Matter expansion of that movement. And President Trump used violence and called out the National Guard to attack these peaceful protesters that were standing in 16th and H. It was a real example of why we needed statehood for D.C. Because we talk about statehood, that we don't have a senator, we don't have a congressperson who can vote. Well, we don't have a governor. And when you have a governor in your state, you can stop the National Guard from being called out over your objections. So that was the first thing that really made statehood kind of a personal safety and security issue for the people of Washington, because we saw what a violent, aggressive response we got from the National Guard. When we didn't, Trump couldn't send the National Guard into Washington State, but he was able to send them into Washington, D.C., not to protect us, not even to protect the property, but to dominate us. Those were his own words. Then you saw the coronavirus relief. We talked about only getting one third of the resources. And then when we need the National Guard and we actually want them to protect life, safety, property, we can't bring them out when we need to. And we saw that on January 6th. And so not having a governor means we can't stop the Guard from coming when we don't want them. We can't get the Guard out quickly when we do need them. And, of course, without a fair shot of safety resources like in coronavirus relief. So people have literally died in Washington, D.C. because we don't have statehood. It's a fierce issue with the urgency of now. We can't allow it to go back. And thankfully, as tragic as all of these instances were, they were a wake-up call for Americans around the country, and we have a sense of momentum that we haven't had before. And so I am excited. And if we get statehood before I can finish taping all 51 of my spots, why?
Now, Senator, what can the civilians, regular civilians, do to try to help with this process to turn D.C. to a legitimate state? What can they do? Is there anything that we can
do? You know, a civilian, the term that you really have there is citizen. Let's talk about our
citizen, yes,
for a minute, because the most important title isn't president or senator or governor or any of these things. It's citizen. Mm-hmm. And citizens have not just the right, but you have duties. You have an obligation to make this democracy better. And so if you are a citizen of the 50 states, then one, right off the bat, you are more powerful than any elected official here in the District of Columbia, regardless of your title, because you are represented by voting members of Congress that in theory at least are accountable to you. And so call them. Call your congressman. Call your senator. If your member of Congress is already on the bill, thank him for that. Let him know that you think it's important, that it's not just a D.C. issue, but an American one. If your senator is not on the bill, tell him to get on the bill, because you support equality for all Americans. You have power that we in Washington, D.C. don't. It is a myth to think that if you live in Washington, you have more power. You have less than most Americans. So citizens, use the rights that you have, but more importantly, the obligation that you have to make our democracy better.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's listening worldwide. Make sure you do this. Senator Paul is telling you right now how to make this change. And it's going to start with us. We have to make this change for it to flow over to senators, to flow over to the president, whoever is in the elected government stage. We have to do this, people. Make sure you go do it. Go do your research on this. Not right now, because you're watching this interview. After this interview, go do your research. Make sure you do that. Now, I know we don't have much more time, Senator, but I do want to ask you a couple more questions. I know you're a busy man, but I got to ask these because people want to know. With the Biden-Kamala Harris era right now, how long do you think it's going to take for all, especially with you too, to help make this United States back to the normal where it's supposed to be?
A lot longer than we would like, but let's remember what really happened. You know, for 4 years, we have been digging this country into a hole. And on January 20th, we finally just put down the shovel. And the truth is that the last few weeks, it wasn't even a shovel. They brought in the backhoe and the jackhammers and dug us real deep, real fast. So we now have to get out of this deep hole that we're in. And it's going to take a lot of work. And it's going to take a lot of work from all of us pulling together. And so, yeah, it was a great day, and I was happy. But the clouds didn't magically part. The virus didn't magically go away. The economy didn't magically start up. Everybody out of work didn't get to go back to work. This is all going to take a lot of effort on our part. This is when the hard work begins. We may have turned the direction around, but we have a long way to go. And the president needs our support, and the vice president needs our support. And they're putting together in a new cabinet, and they're going to need our support. And the newly elected senators and members of Congress need our support. But this is not instantaneous change. This takes. What can you do in your community to begin to make things better?
That's what I'm talking about. Everybody join together. If you have any local communities that's in your area that's trying to help, put everything back the way it is, join them, ask them, what can you do to help? Make sure you do it, because it's going to take, this is my opinion only, Senator. I'm just saying this from me. I believe it's going to take more than one term to get this back to where it's supposed to be. It definitely is. That's just my opinion only.
You're right. It's not just your opinion. I think we all feel that way. And you know what? We have an election in 2022, and that's going to come up on us pretty fast. So one, think about how you can best contribute to saving our democracy. Maybe that means putting your own name on a ballot. Maybe that's finding a good candidate to support and doing what I did as a kid and going down to a campaign headquarters or working virtually. You know, campaigns have changed. You don't even need to go down to a headquarters now. A high-tech campaign will email you a list of phone numbers, and you could start calling voters. You could be working from your own laptop how to reach out to your fellow citizens. So democracy is a lot of work. Get to work, people.
You heard them. You heard a senator. Make sure you get to work. Especially if you're trying to be in this political realm, make sure you do your part. Your vote counts, as you saw. Your vote made a change. Now, 2022 is coming. We need you again. All of us, we need you again. Do your part. Let's get this thing back to normal. Now, one more question about the Joe Biden, Kamala Harris era. How long will it take for you think it's going to get the Democrats and the Republicans kind of getting back on the same page?
It's hard for me to understand what's happening with the Republican Party. I think we're doing a better job as Democrats holding our coalition together. But we represent a pretty wide version of views. So one, you know, we have folks like Bernie Sanders, AOC, the Squad, Elizabeth Warren, and they're on one side of the economic agenda with shared democratic values. We have conservatives from groups like the Lincoln Project that used to be Republicans that were important to helping get the vote out in certain swing states. And then we have sort of moderate centrists like the president who are share our democratic values, but maybe more conservative when it comes to certain economic issues. And so we have to hold our coalition together. The Republicans, they're really split between the old Republican Party and this sort of white supremacist Trump group that has taken over that party. Republicans didn't used to be bad people. They just used to have ideas that I in particular didn't always agree with. But a lot of Republicans of conscience have left the party, become independents. And so we almost have sort of five groups. You know, the Democrats are kind of a three-way coalition. The Republicans are at least evenly divided. So we have to hold out the line with our own caucus, and that's going to be hard because we've got some very conservative members. We got Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who's a pretty conservative guy. And then we have people who represent conservative places like Arizona, home of Barry Goldwater, home of John McCain. And we've got two Democratic senators there now. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the state suddenly became a bastion of left-wing goodness. It's they represent their constituents, and those are conservative constituents. And they're actually obligated to represent those viewpoints. So we need to find a way to bring people together, to move legislation, and hopefully to get a few principled Republicans across on our side. And, yeah, it's great when we can get Republicans to agree and say, well, no, the election was the election, and, of course, we should support Democratic institutions. Yeah, if you incite a violent insurrection against the United States, you should be removed from power. So the Republicans that are voting with us is to support an election that we all saw was free and fair, or the Republicans that voted to impeach the president who clearly incited a violent insurrection. Yeah, we want them. We're glad we have them. But that's different from getting them along on economic issues if we move too fast, too far. At the same time, we can't be timid. You know, they didn't mind rolling all over Democrats when they get to throw people on the courts and do this. We have a job to do. The most important thing is to get this coronavirus relief package out. People are suffering. People are dying. They need help right away. So we need to move quickly on that. Obviously, I want to see us move quickly on statehood. But we need to do that in a way that broadens our base and doesn't narrow it, because as much as we can get done right away, we can find ourselves back in the minority in 2022 if we are not careful. And so we need to be engaging with voters in the key states and all states. We need to be engaging with our fellow legislators on important issues. And we need to lead, as the president says, by the power of our example, but not just the example of our power, and inspire people as well as just count votes.
You heard it here first, people. Now, Senator, I know you have to go. I'm not going to hold you up much longer. There's more questions to ask, but I'm not going to ask them because you have a lot that's going on right now. So we're going to go to the last segment of the show. This right here is called Take the Floor. Now, Senator, you have up to 2 minutes to say whatever you want to say. No questions asked. Senator Paul Strauss, take the floor.
So many of you are out there working for progressive change and fighting to improve and make our democracy better. But if you're not working for DC statehood, all of those efforts will be in vain. If you think about every issue that you care about, right now the United States Senate has been the least democratic institution that's done the most harm to our country. It's where every good idea that we've been able to get has actually gone to die. If you support climate change, but you're not voting to elect two new senators from Washington, D.C. that will fight for the climate, then you're not going to make an impact where you need it to be. If you're concerned about racial equity, if you're concerned about improving our economy so that it works for all Americans, whatever the issue is, you are not going to be able to make the progress you need to make without really changing the United States Senate. Right now, 52 U.S. senators represent only 18% of all Americans. And if you add up the 50 senators elected by the Democrats versus the 50 senators who are Republicans, the Democratic senators represent millions more people. This is fundamentally undemocratic, but we're probably not going to be able to make the fundamental structural change to that body without scrapping our entire constitutional system of government. And whatever our arguments are with it, it has served us better than other places for over 200 years. But one thing we can do, let's make the District of Columbia the 51st state so that we can get two more American United States senators working for all of the American people. We have too many problems right now that we need to work and solve together. And the United States deserves two more voting United States senators from the District of Columbia to help solve those problems. So, Coop, thanks for this great opportunity. I've enjoyed sharing this time with you and your viewers. I appreciate the chance. And if you want to learn more about our struggle for D.C. statehood, visit our website, statehood.dc.gov, or just send me an email at senator@dc.gov. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to keep this dialogue going. Follow me on social media, Twitter, Instagram, and now this new thing called Clubhouse. I'm Ben Paul Strauss. I hope to see you all there.
Make sure you follow him, ladies and gentlemen. And Senator, I would love to have you back on the show in the future.
You got it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, get ready for my next guest. My next guest is, you know, I don't never announce my next guest. You have to stay tuned and make sure you know who it is. Senator Paul Strauss. Make sure you follow him. Make sure you do support him in everything he does. All right, ladies and gentlemen, until the next time on the Bit Scoop with Coop.